fundamental question that is faced by sports is, do they want, will the industry ever allow somebody to tell the truth on the air? But I don't think that today that will ever happen again. I don't think the industry will allow it.
All right, baby, it's time to roll. Let's roll, baby. We rollin'!
Live from the hotbed of mixed martial arts in Las Vegas, your host, pro MMA expert Larry Pepe, takes you into the completely uncut world of MMA. Warning, not for the faint of heart. Pro MMA Radio is not responsible for any side effects, which may include extreme excitement, increased adrenaline levels, and a sudden desire to kick ass. Are you ready? Larry, let's do it.
Welcome to Pro MMA Radio, the official radio show of the American Forces Network, proudly heard in over 170 countries and brought to you by Cytosport Monster Milk. I'm your host, Larry Pepe. UFC 218 is in the books, as is what I believe will be one of the worst-rated cards in UFC history, as it should be, the just-awful-on-paper Ultimate Fighter finale. Dana White goes after GSP and expresses his love of Conor McGregor all within about 15 minutes. And speaking of the Irish superstar, he may have picked a very dangerous fight. First, let's get to our announcements. Jacare versus Brunson 2 headlines Fox 27. That will take place in January in Charlotte, North Carolina. Of course, they fought earlier in their careers. Jacare got the better of Derek Brunson. Will he get the better of him again? Jessica Andrade will take on Carolina Kowalczyk at Fox 28 in Orlando. Hard to believe that Carolina will be able to deal with what Jessica's bringing, if Jessica brings anything that resembled the demolition that she put on Claudia Gadelha in her last fight. UFC 220, it is now official in January 20th in Boston. And despite having a felony charge hanging over his head, Volkan Ozdemir will get the title shot against Daniel Cormier. Of course, this is the fight Cormier wanted. Then Ozdemir got arrested on an outstanding felony warrant. Then Cormier, to his credit, said, hey, bring on Gustafsson. Then Gustafsson, it turns out, underwent surgery. So Ozdemir gets the fight. Of course, in a light heavyweight division where, I don't know, out of the cage behavior, not referring to Cormier, of course referring to John Jones, seemed to be a standard set by the champion. Maybe there's some poetic justice in Ozdemir getting the shot. UFC 222, Hector Lombard versus CB Dolloway. I shake my head when I say Hector Lombard's name because aside from Will Brooks, they are in a race to see who is the biggest bust coming over from Bellator. Dana White, speaking to a group of media the week of UFC 218, had some real gems. And first, I want to get to the Ultimate Fighter and his comments on that because it kind of segues into just this horrendous decision to launch this 125-pound division. He said, and I'm quoting, I had to go back, rewind it, make sure I heard it right, that the Ultimate Fighter is the toughest competition in all of sports. Remember, that's a quote. Quote. The Ultimate Fighter is the toughest competition in all of sports. End quote. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that the Tour de France, for example, might be slightly tougher than living in a mansion in Las Vegas for 6 weeks, training twice a day, and being able to write down all the food and whatever you want brought to you by the people who work for the program. I'm just going to go out on a limb. Just going to say that, I don't know, doing these ultra marathons where you run 100 miles, doing a triathlon, doing the Tour de France, it seems to me, I'm going to go crazy, and I'm going to say that that's a bit more challenging than the scenario I just described. Now, segueing from that, what a complete disaster this 125-pound division has turned out to be already. First off, there was so much interest in it that the ratings were, I believe, the worst in Tough history. I know one of the episodes was the lowest rated episode they've ever done across 26, 27 seasons, whatever it is. So the ratings were horrendous, which should tell you some level of interest or lack thereof in the general public for yet another women's division. Two women made it to the final that no one ever heard of, Nico Montana and Sajara Eubanks. Then it turned out that Eubanks got sick and had to pull out the day before the fight because her weight cut went south. Then Roxanne Modafferi gets the title fight after a loss, which, of course, these days is almost common, right? So she steps into the title shot against Nico Montana. Then she loses to Montana, who at 5-2 becomes your inaugural 125-pound champion until Valentina Shevchenko destroys her and dominates what looks like nothing more than a bad Invicta division with a UFC belt attached to it. Now, listen, you know, if you listen to the show, you know that I love great fighting. I love great technique. I love talented fighters. You know that there are several women's fighters that I think are fantastic and I champion on this show, one of whom, Amanda Nunes, I gave my Fighter of the Year in 2016, and the other, the aforementioned Valentina Shevchenko, I think the world of. I think she's an amazing mixed martial artist, and I am a big fan of when she fights. I truly enjoy watching her fight, I think. And I think her improvements on the ground. We know she's an elite striker, but anytime a fighter truly rounds out their game, I am quick to give them credit. But this division is horrible. Horrible. Then the broadcast, of course, with Grisham and Daniel Cormier was terrible, including Cormier interviewing Lauren Murphy after she beat Barb Honchak and referring to her as Barb. There was zero or less than zero interest in this thing. And here's where I think they went completely wrong. They should have had, in my opinion, if they were going to add this division, which I would not have, what they should have done, in my opinion, was they should have crowned a winner of the show on the show, not at the Tough finale. I think they should have gone through the tournament, and the final fight should have taken place the last week of the actual program. And then that person, of course, they would have a couple of months to prepare because then they would have come off the show and, you know, it's taped before and so on. That person then should have fought Valentina Shevchenko for the 125-pound belt. So now you have an established name and an established fighter who would bring respect to the division either way. Because if whoever was on the show beat Shevchenko, that is a huge win and immediately gives them a level of credibility that, believe me, Nico Montana does not have today. Or Shevchenko is the queen of the 125-pound division, and that gives it immediate credibility. They weren't smart enough to do either one of those things. And last but not least, because I guarantee you when these numbers come out, they will be horrendous. The Tough coaches, even though they have no heat, but the Tough coaches who are a fantastic matchup that would definitely get people tuning in, they should have main evented. So your co-main event would have been Shevchenko versus the winner of the show. Your main event, Gaethje versus Alvarez. Now I am making sure to tune in. This card on paper, I went up and down, and I had no interest in this card whatsoever. Then, icing on the cake, Dana says that there is less interest in the 125-pound division than he thought there would be in terms of fighters moving into the division. So basically, it's mostly going to be Valentina Shevchenko destroying everyone on Tough that no one watched. But then he goes on to say, doubles down on the women's side of the sport, citing that Cyborg Home is headlining their year-end show, that this whole season of Tough was about women, and they just added another division. So wait a second. So the numbers don't matter. So it's a success because you keep adding to it defiantly, stubbornly, and stupidly, because you have a 145-pound division that basically consists of one woman. You have a 125-pound division with a champion that, with all due respect, should not be wearing a UFC championship belt. That's, at best, an Invicta champion. And then you have 115 and 135. So, Home Jermaine Durandamé does horrendous numbers, 200,000. Noon Shevchenko, too, did 100,000 buys, 100. They're not going to do big numbers on 219. Let me just be the bearer of bad news right now. It's not going to happen. And Tough was a ratings disaster. No one cares about this division, but the proof that it was a great idea to now have four divisions is just that you keep adding them. The numbers don't matter. And by the way, UFC 219, Holly Holm versus Cyborg being your main event of a year-end show, I really have not paid enough attention on this show to how much this fight demonstrates what a disaster this joke of a division is. Holm is 1-3 in her last four with a win over, wait for it, perhaps the worst fighter on the roster in Betch Correa. Certainly the worst fighter to ever fight for a belt as a title challenger. And Holm is 0-1 at 145 pounds, and she is fighting for a title at 145 pounds. It also shows that divisions, accomplishments, and belts mean absolutely nothing again. We're going to go to a quick break. When we come back, one of Dana White's favorite targets, unbelievably, is in his crosshairs yet again.
This is Cain Velasquez, and you're listening to Pro MMA Radio.
You really do have to wonder what George St. Pierre ever did to Dana White besides sell more pay-per-views for him than any fighter in UFC history. In that same luncheon, Dana went on to say the following about St. Pierre. Quote, I want to hear he's going to defend his 185-pound title. That's the agreement we made. That's the deal we made when we made the deal. I'm going to be super pissed if he doesn't, and I don't know where we go from there. That's the language in the contract. Go to 170. Who's better to fight at 170? You've got Woodley, you've got Wonderboy, you've got Romero, and then you've got Luke Rockhold. They're all monsters. There's no fight that looks like, oh, maybe this is the fight for me to take. You looked at Bisping like he was a tune-up. You got your tune-up. There's nothing but effing animals at 85 and 70. To sit there and try to handpick people or where you want to go and everything else, you can't do that in this effing sport. You're a fighter. Get in there and see who you can effing beat. You wanted to effing come back. Welcome back. It's ugly. Then he goes on to say that the rumor of GSP McGregor must have originated from GSP's camp. Quote, there's never been one discussion ever about GSP versus Conor, ever. So that's all internet blank that I'm assuming got started on that side. Every fight with Conor is a big money fight, and Tony Ferguson is next in line. How much bigger is GSP versus Conor than Conor versus anybody? End quote. Honestly, If he can say with a straight face that GSP Conor is no bigger than GSP Tony Ferguson, then he needs to be removed from his position at UFEC effective immediately. Because that is, again, it's a tough list to make, but clearly in the top 10 of dumbest things he's ever said. And it only shows how badly he wants to protect Conor McGregor. The biggest money fight they could make, the most pay-per-views they would ever sell in the company's history is George St. Pierre versus Conor McGregor. Period. This attack on St. Pierre about, oh, you want to pick, you want to, you know, good luck, welcome back, you wanted to effing come back, you would think this was his enemy. You would think this guy was fighting for Bellator. You would think that he was Ben Askren, who we know Dana despises and prevented from coming into the UFC, which is a tremendous regret for any fan or any thinking MMA fan who would have loved to have found out who the best 170 of all time was, who might be Ben Askren. We're going to get to him in a minute. But this idea of attacking St. Pierre, who he's always had what I would describe as an uncomfortable relationship with, is a bit bizarre, especially now, weeks after he beats Bisping and makes history. Then we find out that St. Pierre is dealing with colitis and that he's going to be out for a while. So who knows, you know, when that'll happen. What's interesting to me as well is that Dana likes to paint certain people as like cowards. He likes to, like, he's painting St. Pierre like, oh, you don't want to defend against these guys at 85 because you're trying to handpick a fight. I mean, this is a guy who ran through the murderer's row of welterweights in his time and just claimed his second belt. But that said, let's not forget, because Dana apparently has, or he didn't bother to find out, George was very vocal after beating Bisping that it made him physically sick to try to keep the weight on at 185 pounds to the point that he was throwing up the morning of the fight. So again, it's interesting to mention Bisping in this because it's clear from what Yufek did with Bisping in China and everything we were screaming about here that the rest of the media has finally decided after the fact, when it means nothing, to raise the question as to whether Michael Bisping should have been fighting, more on that later, that they could care less about the health and safety of these fighters. So if you have George St. Pierre saying, listen, I don't think I can keep the weight on at 85. It was difficult. I got sick. I was throwing up the morning of the fight. It's difficult for me to fight in this weight class. Believe me, if that was Conor McGregor saying, I can't stay at 55, Dana would be saying, hey, Conor's a warrior, but he can't hold the weight on at 55, so he's going back to 45, and he would praise him for doing what he had to do to go up to 55 in the first place and even be able to survive and make it through the fight. But when it's George St. Pierre, he paints him as this complete coward who's looking for an easy fight and then basically says he got his easy fight in Michael Bisping, which is completely discrediting your former middleweight champion who you just threw into the cage 3 weeks after he was potentially concussed and choked unconscious to get knocked out again. Speaking of Ben Askren, Askren retired. We talked about that, said that the only way he would come back would be to fight GSP. I saw a ridiculous article out there dismissing it, that the UFC wouldn't even be considered. Because, you know, it's not all about talent, it's about style. Listen, if Yufek had true promotional ability, Ben Askren versus GSP is an extremely marketable fight. For those of you who have not seen much of Askren because he went over to Asia and fought for ONE FC after his Bellator contract was up because the UFC didn't want him, because at 12-0, undefeated welterweight champion from Bellator, Dana thought he should go get more experience in World Series of Fighting. Just let that resonate for a second. When you think of the people who fight in the UFC, when you think you just crowned a, quote, champion in the women's 125-pound division who was in her sixth or seventh fight, and Ben Askren at 12-0, and oh yeah, represented the United States at the Olympic Games in 2008 in wrestling, that Ben Askren. That guy needed to go get more experience. Asinine, okay? But you can't market Ben Askren, who trash talks, who's got that history, who's undefeated against George St. Pierre. Come on. Come on. The fact that they would never even consider it is one of the reasons they're where they're at right now. And the punchline is that in the same luncheon or media scrum, whatever you want to call it, Dana said that he's meeting with, you guessed it, Phil Brooks. Quote, I love the guy. We'll see what he's doing. So Phil Brooks, the 0-0, never fought amateur or professional in any discipline in mixed martial arts in his life, more self-confessed concussions than seconds of legitimate fight time in his life. He was good enough to be on a UFC pay-per-view, but Ben Askren, who represented the United States at the Olympic Games and is undefeated at welterweight, is not. That's why they're in the position they are, and that's why the sport is not taken seriously as a sport like it used to be. It has gone backwards, not forwards. Of course, we talked about Woodley Diaz being a possibility at one point. Dana White says it was never offered. Quote, one of our attorneys here started playing matchmaker and said he had a good rapport with the Diaz brothers, and he basically said, what if you could fight Tyrone Woodley? Me and Sean Shelby were like, how does he deserve to fight Tyrone Woodley? There's an effing list of guys that are waiting to fight Tyrone Woodley, and this dude's going to fight? What are you talking about? So he kind of went off the reservation a little bit and started playing matchmaker. That's why you started hearing Woodley saying, I got offered a fight with Nate Diaz, and we're like, no, there was never a fight. Woodley's been talking about needing shoulder surgery, I need shoulder surgery, and then he's like, I'll fight Nate Diaz, and starts calling him out. It was a nightmare. None of that was true. Tyrone Woodley, the next day, says, quote, delusional Dana constantly demotes me as a fighter when the job is to promote his fighters, especially champions. Why would I get in camp? And why would Nate give a $15 million purse request if there was no fight? It's obvious they haven't found their blockbuster headliner yet. This was a reality, and they know it. The inability to come to financial terms with Nate killed it. And if you're wondering what Nate said, since he's the only other party besides Woodley who would know, he went on social media referring to Dana and said, quote, shut up, rhymes with which, you're both thirsty, and why is you lying? I'll let you decide who you believe. Enough on fighters that Dana White denigrates. Let's get to his man crush next.
Former heavyweight champion Randy the Natural Couture, and you're listening to Pro MMA Radio.
Welcome back to Pro MMA Radio. I'm your host, Larry Pepe. You can follow me on Twitter at Larry Pepe, last four letters, P-E-P-E. And this segment brought to you by our friends at Cytosport Monster Milk. So Dana White, of course, spoke about his man crush. And the question came up of, was there going to be any punishment on the UFC side for Conor McGregor for his behavior at UFC 187, what is now 3 weeks later, and the UFC has been radio silent. Quoting, he was being dealt with by the head of the ABC. We were going to fight him regardless of what his manager says. We were working on a fight for him at the end of the year, and he's just not ready, end quote. Now, I want you to think for a moment about how asinine that statement is. We were working on a fight for him at the end of the year, and he's just not ready. So you didn't have him booked. You weren't going to fight him at the end of the year because, by your own words, he's not ready to fight by the end of the year. So him not fighting at the end of the year is not taking anything away from him at all. But the bigger thing, not that any media member in the room called him out on it, is that Mike Mazzulli, who is the head of the ABC, his last statement is that he can't do anything. So that's a flat-out lie. Mike Mazzulli, when interviewed about McGregor's behavior, said that he did not have jurisdiction over McGregor, but if he did, he would suspend him indefinitely and make him appear before the commission to determine when and how and if he should get his license back. But he specifically said, I have to check with my lawyers, but I don't think I have any jurisdiction over him. It would have to be the New York or Nevada commissions because they had both licensed him in the last 2 years and he had a valid license with both. So the idea that Mazzulli is dealing with it is complete BS. Of course, no one in the room asked as well. Well, wait a second. Fabricio Werdum throws a boomerang at Colby Covington, and within hours, the UFC is putting out a statement that it's being reviewed under their code of conduct to see if it's a violation. Colby Covington makes disparaging statements about Brazilians in the cage in Brazil, and at the post-fight press conference, a UFC executive is saying it's going to be reviewed by the fantasy pretend board of code of conduct people that doesn't exist to our knowledge because they never do anything in the UFC. So this idea like, hey, they're handling that when the person he says is handling it has specifically said he can't handle it. No one follows up, of course, because it's basically a PR meeting and they move on. Then he talks some more about the incident at 187. Quote, he's a young rich kid who's a god in Ireland. That's not the healthiest environment either. It's all part of it. I don't know if you guys remember in the very beginning with John Jones. There's no doubt the talent was there. I used to go, the guy is talented, but he's young, he's rich, he's the king of the world now. Hopefully he can keep it together. That was way before the crazy stuff started to happen. And there it is. It happens. Connor has a lot too. When he travels, he's got friggin' people for days with him. When you make that kind of money, you're that famous, you're a professional athlete, you're going to have an overload of Klingons. So it's not Connor's fault. It's the Klingons, right? Okay. They pushed him to jump the cage like a lunatic at Bellator 187. Got it. Then he said that he's not sure about McGregor vacating the belt or even if he'll fight again. He said, right now, we're working on a new deal with him. Well, he was under contract already, so why they'd even be working on a new deal, I don't know. Especially after they just let him do the stupidest thing they could have done and fight Mayweather, get his ass kicked, make a boatload of money so he never has to fight again. Then he goes on to say, tell me if any of this sounds familiar. Quote, listen, Conor might never fight again. That guy's got effing $100 million. These guys make money and that's it. Fighting is the worst. Try to get up and get punched in the face every day when you've got $100 million in the bank. Money changes everything for a lot of people, end quote. Now, number one, he doesn't have $100 million. That's ridiculous. But he's got plenty of money. He has generational money. I'm sure that him, the next generation of McGregors, and the next generation after that never has to worry about money again. But remember, we said here a long time ago, hey, who knows what motivation Conor is going to have? Who knows if he's going to want to continue to train for fights and fight and go through all this if he's independently wealthy? Now Dana's saying it. But then he says that he knew that letting Conor do the Mayweather fight might mean that he would never fight for the UFC again, which I find to be an amazing admission. Because if this deal goes south and investors want to sue, just bring this in as Exhibit A. You have the president of the company admitting that he made a decision, and UFEC made a decision, that put them in a position to lose their biggest, best financial draw. And the company owes, and Dana owes, a fiduciary responsibility to the investors. And he is admitting, and has admitted several times, that he acted in a way that he knew was against his fiduciary responsibility to his investors. It is truly amazing. Tell you what's more amazing. There are rumors, now it's confirmed, that Conor got into a bar fight in Ireland. And it said that there's various accounts. I will read you some of it. It says police in Dublin were recently made aware of eyewitness testimony that places McGregor smack dab in the middle of a Sunday night bar fight inside the Black Forge in the capital's Crumlin suburb. And they went on to say that he was seen entering the pub before the fight erupted and that he hit It was said to involve McGregor, a young man, another man in his 50s, and a fourth man. Now, Paul Williams is apparently a famous crime reporter for several decades, and he went on to say, quote, "I have to say about this, and I'm wearing my old veteran crime reporter hat, I have to say Conor McGregor is in a very dangerous place right now. He has come into conflict, probably through no fault of his own, with a group of very, very dangerous people who are tied up with the Kinahans. These people do not care who Conor McGregor is, what he stands for, how powerful he is. They will drag him down to the cesspit. I would say in the next 48 hours, if he is still in the country, and I understand he may have left the country for a few days, I understand from my sources that he will be approached to give him a message, which is basically to tell him that there may be threats to his safety. This is a huge story, and imagine what it would do to our national reputation if this sporting icon was attacked by a bunch of gangsters." It turns out that one of the people that he hit is rumored to be basically a gangster in Ireland, not people that you want to mess with. And Dana White dismissed it, said, "Oh, I don't think that happened. It would be big news, blah, 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 because everything Conor does is big news, you know, because he's got a man crush on him. He's in love with him. That's fine." But if there's truth to the story, and I believe wholeheartedly that there is truth to the story, I believe that when you deal with gangsters, when you deal with mobsters, you pay one way or the other. And I can only tell you that growing up in New York and being around people like that at times, that if you punched a 50-something-year-old mobster, you were going to pay with body parts or money. And I suspect the same would be true of Irish mobsters, New York mobsters. I think there's probably a consistency in the way that they handle things. So we'll see how the story evolves. We may never hear about it if he has to pay them off or does pay them off. Or maybe it's all a big story, but there's no question, at least from the reports that I read and the various accounts on various social media, this crime reporter, it does appear that he was certainly involved in this bar fight, and it does not sound good in that respect. Then it turns out, a couple of days later, he apparently was supposed to appear in court in Ireland because he had a traffic violation of some sort. And here's the report on that. The UFC star was due to appear in district court this morning, but initially failed to show. His attorney admitted he didn't know where he was, and Judge Miriam Walsh fumed, quote, "I'm getting nothing but fingers from Mr. McGregor. If he's making a case, he has to be here. This is absolute disrespect to the court. I'm very annoyed with Mr. McGregor." Turns out at that time, when he's supposed to be in court, he was home taking a selfie of himself in a tracksuit and posting it to social media. The judge agreed to push the appearance back until later in the day. He showed up and put a "relax judge" hashtag on social media. And then when he left, posted "come and get me," which some people believe may have been an Irish mob reference. So he ends up paying a fine and so on. So basically, so just so we can kind of put it all into perspective, he pisses off a judge, is late for a court appearance. He may or may not have punched a mob associate in a bar fight, caused an absolute ruckus in verbally and physically assaulting a referee and a Bellator official on tape at Bellator 187, and dropped multiple homophobic and racist slurs all in the last 60 days. This does not sound like it has a happy ending. It sounds more like McGregorstein is completely unhinged and off the rails.
Hey, this is John Jones, and I listen to Pro MMA Radio.
All right, before we move to UFC 218, a quick correction. Apparently, on the call for the tough finale was not Todd Grisham, but a guy named Dan Helly. And in the words of Conor McGregor, I don't know who the blank that is. All right, UFC 218 actually had a two-man booth, which was great. It was Anik and Rogan, which meant that we didn't have to hear three guys competing for a microphone. And no Daniel Cormier and Joe Rogan going back and forth, stepping all over each other and the action. So that was a step in the right direction. The real step in the right direction is acknowledging that Max Holloway is going to be the featherweight champion, I think, for quite some time. He dominates Jose Aldo, finishes him in the third round. Aldo had his moments, threw more leg kicks than he did the first time, paced himself a little bit. First two rounds were close, but was very similar in some respects to the first fight in that Aldo was competitive in rounds one and two. A lot of people had him winning both rounds the first time they fought, but it was clear kind of by the second half of the second round, the first time and this time, that Max was starting to kind of get his pace down and starting to take over, and then the finish comes in the third. One thing that I don't think you're going to hear a lot of people point out, the announcers ignored it completely, but Max consistently threw a right hand to the body. Not a right hand uppercut, but a straight right to Aldo's body right from the beginning of round one, which is exactly what Floyd Mayweather does, which is a very underappreciated technique that definitely tires your opponent out if you keep hitting them in the solar plexus and the stomach with that sharp right hand. And I saw Max starting to do that. Then he started to work in uppercuts. Clearly he knew that Aldo would have a very difficult time with his cardio, and that was a way to wear him out, and it worked perfectly. Aldo, look, it's not like Jose Aldo sucks. You could argue Max Holloway is the best featherweight champion, but as a champion, Aldo has all the records. He's a phenomenal fighter. He's not the fighter he was, but the bad news for him is that as long as Max Holloway is at the top of the division, he has no chance of being the champion and probably no chance of even fighting for the belt again. If Max were to lose the belt, that might be a different story, but I don't see that happening anytime soon. But Aldo still, in all likelihood, a top five featherweight. It's just that Max Holloway is a lot better, and he proved it. And props to Holloway. I think the things that stood out to me besides the right hand were he has an ironclad chin, which, of course, is bad news for everybody. And he's very good defensively at slipping out of the way, but then being right back on top of you again and pressuring. And that pressure just wilted Aldo. I thought Herb Dean was late on the stoppage. The referees were absolutely horrendous with a capital H. I'm going to get to that in a moment. Referees were more or less not needed. For Francis, judges certainly not needed. Apparently, when Francis Ngannou fights, you can just tell the judges to take a bathroom break, go eat a sandwich, because it's not going the distance. He decapitates Alistair Overeem with a vicious one-punch knockout, a left hook that had him out before he ever hit the canvas. A minute and 42 seconds into the very first round, he moves to 6-0 in the UFC with six straight finishes, the last four all coming in under 2 minutes of the very first round. He now gets Miocic. If I were Miocic, I might consider just giving him the belt. But I'm not a fighter. Not anymore, anyway. So Stipe Miocic will obviously not just give him the belt, but at the end of the night, I believe he's going to give him the belt, because I don't think Stipe Miocic has any chance of taking more than one or two shots from Francis Ngannou. I said it going into the Overeem fight. I said it going into the Arlovsky fight. This guy's punches, his power, are just on another level. And until somebody shows me otherwise, good luck. The power he has, truly, I think, is unlike anything we've seen. The force, if you did not see the fight, I'm sure there's highlights out there, low lights if you're Alistair Overeem. Watch Overeem's head snap back, the velocity with which his head snaps back when Nagano hits him with that punch was almost frightening. Like if his skin wasn't tight enough, his head might have flown off his shoulders. That's how hard he hits. I don't know who's going to deal with that. Henry Cejudo dominates Sergio Pettis, 30-27 on all three cards. I want to tell you in MMA, when you know that a guy is in deep trouble, when he tells the announcers to give a shout-out to the high school wrestling team that helped him prepare to fight the youngest United States Olympian to ever gold medal in wrestling. And that was the difference. Look, Cejudo more than stood his own on the feet with Pettis, although you wouldn't have known it from the call. But his wrestling was there all three rounds. He took Pettis down. Pettis couldn't do a thing. That's what happens when you're a gold medalist. You have that option. Your opponent generally does not. And it was a dominant performance. I also thought, at one point, I know that Sergio Pettis is young. He's got a bright future in this division and all that good stuff. He finally gets up. He's down clearly there were less than a minute left in the third round, and he's able to get back to his feet, and he's throwing jabs. I mean, from a fight IQ standpoint, again, I know he's young, but he's been fighting a long time for a young guy, comes from a solid camp. His brother was a world champion. You're down 14 minutes to nothing. You have to throw caution to the wind and just let it all hang out there, and then inexplicably goes for a takedown. Yeah. Against a gold medalist wrestler in a fight that he's losing 14 minutes to nothing. For his part, Henry Cejudo gets no post-fight interview. And here's what's wrong with UFEC and their negligent promotional malpractice. This guy is a gold medalist who represented the United States in wrestling. He's got that pedigree. He's the second best 125er in the world. He just dominated Sergio Pettis after dominating the guy that Demetrius Johnson beat in a recent title defense. No interview? Nothing? Like, this isn't a promotable guy if you're going to try to promote anybody at 125 besides Demetrius. Well, they haven't promoted him either. But this isn't the guy? No interview? I mean, I can't remember the last time a main event pay-per-view fighter doesn't get an interview, especially after a dominant performance, but under any circumstances. Eddie Alvarez got an interview, which should tell you that Justin Gaethje suffered his first loss. Alvarez by TKO with 1 minute and 1 second left in the third round. Alvarez knees him to the face. Gaethje goes down. Alvarez finishes with a couple of punches. The referee steps in. Gaethje tries to get up. He can't even get up on his own accord. But the real story here was Gaethje's leg kicks, which you would have thought were basically the only thing being landed in the fight based on the commentary. But Eddie to the body and uppercuts. That was the key. And the thing I noticed with Justin in this fight that I'm sure he's done it before, I just hadn't taken quite as much notice of it, was very evident with Eddie. He bites on everything. Every time Eddie moved to throw a punch, both hands go up in front of his face, and that's it. And he kind of stands there. So if you study that, if you see that, or even if it's a pattern you see unfolding in the fight, his body is there for the taking. Portions of his head are there for the taking because he's basically behind two gloves. And I think that's something he's really going to have to work on with Trevor Whitman, who's obviously elite, coaches Rose Namajunas in striking, because he can't do that to this level of fighter and just let them tee off on him and expect that he's not going to pay the price at some point. I had Eddie up 2-0 going into the third. He finishes him in the third, so a big win for Eddie Alvarez. Big win for Tisha Torres. She beats Michelle Waterson. It was a clear 29-28. One of the judges had it 30-27. How they could give Tisha Torres the second round with Waterson on top of her for about 4 minutes is beyond me. A horrible performance there, but a big performance for Tisha, who continues to move up in this 115-pound division. On your prelims, Paul Felder knocks out Charles Oliveira in the second round by ground and pound. Dan Murgliato, who I have for a long time hailed as the worst referee that any of us can recognize or name in MMA. This was a piece de resistance in incompetence. In the first round, Oliveira knees Felder right in the face when they are on the ground, when he's working for one choke after another. Impossible to miss in that sequence since they've been on the ground for about a minute and a half. He's been working for chokes. You would think the referee is going to be close to the action so that as he's locking this choke in, he's making sure that Felder isn't going unconscious. He knees him right in the face, and Murgliato does nothing. Then, to Felder's credit, he works through all those choke attempts, comes back in the second round, puts Oliveira down, lands a huge elbow in the ground and pound position. He's on top. Oliveira taps him three or four times on his shoulder. And Dan Murgliato, again, maybe out of position, maybe just grossly unbelievable, doesn't step in. And Oliveira takes six more elbows to the head. Six more before Murgliato steps in. A huge win for Felder. Fantastic. But Murgliato should be arrested. He is just criminally incompetent. And the thing that's sickening is that these promotions and these commissions don't care enough about the health and safety of these fighters to, when you see this kind of incompetence, suspend these referees. Hold them accountable, for God's sakes, because they have the lives and the future of these fighters in their hands. When they're refereeing, and incompetence just goes unpunished, and that's why we see it for a decade from the same people. Yancy Medeiros defeats the Brazilian Cowboy by TKO, round three, a fantastic fight, back and forth, both in deep trouble. I think the real turning point was that Medeiros broke Oliveira's nose in the first round. He was clearly having trouble breathing, and he gassed badly by the third round, and Medeiros took advantage of it. Also winning, David Tamer beat Dracar close, unanimous decision. Felice Herrig defeated a shocked, I have no idea why, Courtney Casey by split decision. It was a clear 29-28 for Herrig, so I don't know what Casey was thinking. Amanda Cooper absolutely dominated Angela Magana. TK Oder in the second round, but that doesn't even tell the story. It was complete domination. And Herb Dean decided that he wanted to give Murgliato a standard of incompetence to live up to, since this fight was earlier. He stops the Al-Hassan Tomasi fight completely wrongly. It is a slugfest. Al-Hassan lands. Tomasi goes down, but it looks like half of a slip. He's going literally for a takedown, and Dean steps in and waves off the fight. But he's the best in the business because Dana White's been telling us that for years, except that he's not. Dominic Reyes defeats Jeremy Kimball, submits him by rear naked choke in the first round. And Justin Willis defeats Alan Crowder by knockout, 2 minutes and 33 seconds of the very first round. Last but not least, I just want to say, I know they announced, you know, Buffer announced that it was a sold-out crowd. I saw empty red seats all over the place. When the FS1 prelim started, there was, like, no one. And then as the fights went on, it did not seem like it completely filled up. So it is what it is. It was a fantastic card. I thought some of the fights were great, some fantastic performances. And Max Holloway is still your UFC featherweight champion.
Hey, it's Steve Austin. You're listening to Pro MMA Radio with Larry Pepe. And that's the bottom line, because Stone Cold said so.
All right, as we head down the home stretch, our final segment this week brought to you by Cytosport Monster Milk. And the numbers just came out that the attendance was 17,587. I did a quick Google search, and it turns out the arena has a capacity of 19,515, which in my book, when you have 2,000 seats that are unsold, that is not what I'd call a sellout. Call me crazy. All right. There was lots of stuff this week about Michael Bisping. Joe Rogan came out, said, hey, I don't think it was a really good idea to let him fight. I saw some articles on different websites. And my only question is, where was everybody when it mattered? Like, it's real easy after the fact to bring up that it's not a good idea that somehow, miraculously, a guy's medical suspension gets reduced from 30 days to 7 when you need a main event fighter. The guy just got concussed. The guy just got choked unconscious. And now everybody wants to talk about it after he gets knocked out and concussed potentially again? Give me a break. That is what is wrong. All right, next week, Fight Night 123, Cub Swanson, Brian Ortega is your main event. Jason Knight, Gabriel Benitez, Marlon Moraes, Aljamain Sterling. That should be an interesting fight. Aside from that, not a lot jumps off the page at me, but that will take place in Fresno, California, and it will be televised on FS1. Next week, we'll get a little bit more into women's MMA and some of the issues we see kind of coming out of that. We will recap the fight night card from Fresno. And I'm sure, because it's MMA, that we will have plenty to talk about. That brings us to the close of another episode of Pro MMA Radio, the official radio show of the American Forces Network. For all the incredible men and women listening to us on AFN, our sincerest thanks and prayers go out to all of you for everything you do. Remember, you can listen to this and other episodes of the show 24/7 by visiting our website at ProMMAradio.com, and you can catch us live next week right back here. Until then, have a kick-ass week. Be safe. And that's a wrap.
You've been listening to Pro MMA Radio, your all-access pass to go beyond the fight. Make sure to visit ProMMAradio.com and full on-demand replays and show updates available 24/7. Come on.